It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret will be back on Monday. Coming up, we'll talk to an outdoors writer about some sports that'll get you outside and taking advantage of the Wisconsin winter. First this week, a 48-year-old Milwaukee man, Gary Douglas, became the 109th gun homicide of the year in Wisconsin. Among those wounded by gunfire this week was a 17-year-old Milwaukee male. His injury added to the increase this year in the number of juveniles killed or wounded by gunshots compared to last year. As part of our series on gun violence, Chuck Kornbach prepared this look at some of the high-profile cases involving children in 2014.
You said that you were trying to bring it out.
Getting the attention of any four-year-old can be a challenge, but in a few moments, Janila Marsh Hyshaw stops bouncing around and comes over to say her name.
Janila.
And how are you today?
I'm good.
This was Janila's last day at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin before heading home from the Wauwatosa facility after about a six-week stay. The Racine girl was sitting in a parked car hit by gunfire on November 5th. A bullet hit Janila's head just above her right eyebrow. Despite that, Janila's mother, Janika Marsh, says her daughter is doing pretty well.
Walking, talking, dancing, her memory seems to be excellent. Like, she remembers what she was doing at the moment. She remembers being faced. She remembers it happening.
But Janila isn't completely healed. She wears a pink helmet to protect part of her skull that will be repaired during an upcoming surgery. Janika Marsh also worries a bit about how her kindergartner will do in school.
I'm more concerned with the things that she has yet to learn, like the things that she already learned that's kind of set in, but I'm not sure which way the future learning process will go.
Marsh hopes people learn to put the weapons down, as she says many other parents and relatives have also suffered when kids are hit by gunfire.
We want to personally thank everyone for their outpouring of love, prayers, and support.
That's Tracy Martinez, aunt of Layla Peterson, a 5-year-old Milwaukee girl killed when two men opened fire outside her family's home just a day after Janila Marsh Hyshaw was wounded in Racine. At a news conference, Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn held up a photo of Layla and put it in his uniform's front shirt pocket.
I'm going to do one thing, and I'm going to do it till those guys go to jail. And I'm going to have this baby right next to the pocket with my grandchildren. She's going to stay there.
But 7 weeks later, police have not announced any arrests in Peterson's killing. The Milwaukee Police Department has had to deal this year with a rise in gun incidents involving children. Youth homicides are down by 3 from last year, but non-fatal shootings of juveniles are up by more than a dozen to more than 70. The higher toll occasionally prompts politicians to call for changes, such as in July when Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett talked about the passing of 10-year-old Sierra Guyton. Guyton was caught in a crossfire between felons with guns while they were on a Milwaukee playground in May.
It underscores the need for stronger laws in Madison. It underscores the need right here in this community for a lot of people to do some soul searching, because we have far too many people in this community who use violence as a way to solve their problems.
But until the gun violence decreases, people like Milwaukee School Superintendent Darian Driver says she'll worry about the kids. That means both the ones hit by bullets and ones who experience trauma just by living in violent neighborhoods.
It's not always being a witness to some type of a violent incident. Sometimes something as simple as just walking to school and you see a memorial.
Driver says the Milwaukee District is working on improving safe zones around schools and making more use of youth counselors. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now that it's officially winter, you might feel like hibernating until the warm weather is here again. But if you like to enjoy the outdoors and be active, there's no reason you can't get outside in the wintertime. Well, we want to hear from you on this topic. What do you enjoy about the outdoors in the Wisconsin winter? What's your favorite winter sport and why? Why do you love it? What sports make you love winter? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tom Held is with us to share some ideas if you want to get outside at this time of year. He's a freelance writer and blogger for The Active Pursuit and Silent Sports magazine. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So it's hard to get outside when the weather isn't warm and welcoming. And right now in southern Wisconsin, we've got a bit of a heat wave, but that's about to turn around. What is the appeal of getting outside when it's really cold?
Well, a couple of things. For athletes, you certainly get a great workout. You're burning a lot of calories. Snowshoeing, you're burning about 600 calories an hour. Cross-country skiing, you can get up to about 1,000 calories per hour. So for one thing, it's a great way to counter what we've been doing over the holidays, and that's eating a lot of high-sugar foods, which tend to boost a few pounds this time of year. And then it's getting out into the natural environment at a fantastic time of year. You know, the snow in the woods is gorgeous, the quiet in winter with the sound muffled by the snow, animal tracks, the different light that you see in the sky with the sun at a low angle. It just gives you an opportunity to explore areas that you may enjoy in summer, but with a whole different viewpoint, sensory stimulation in a lot of different ways.
Now, going back to what you said about the calorie burning, that's an awful lot of calories for an hour of cross-country skiing. Is that because it's colder, so your body has to work harder to warm itself, or is it just the nature of the exercise?
A little bit of both. Primarily the nature of the exercise. Cross-country skiing works your entire body. You're propelling yourself with your upper body and your lower body. And that 1,000 calories is on, more of a competitive number, but you're easily in the 400 to 600 range just if you're going out for a recreational ski.
Wow. Well, that's pretty good. So you don't have to be a Birkebeiner, but you do have to be kind of pushing it a little.
Yeah, exactly. And cross-country skiing is a sport that really has is very accessible. The old adage is that if you can walk, you can go cross-country skiing, and I think it's pretty much true. You know, just find a nice flat area and some snow and give it a try.
Sometimes the cost of gear can be expensive if you just want to try it out for once and see if you like it. How does cross-country skiing do as far as the cost?
It's the price points on that are a lot better than downhill skiing. And you can rent skis for anywhere from $25 to $40 for an afternoon. There's some places in Milwaukee like the Urban Ecology Center where you could take them for up to a week. And a family membership is all that you need for that, and that's a real inexpensive option as well. And then to buy equipment, you're looking at probably anywhere, in the $200 price range for a package of boots, bindings, poles, and skis. Snowshoes would be a good option for that, too, because the price point's a little bit less, $100 for a good recreational pair, and you can also find places that rent them. Some of the ski shops in various places across the state have those, and REI and the Recreational Equipment International, and also, again, the Urban Ecology Center in Milwaukee has options for that.
When are kids able to start trying their hand at some of these things so you could do sort of a family outing, cross-country skiing or snowshoeing?
Yeah, well, I have twin daughters, and we were pulling them. Our jogger also converted to had a ski attachment. So I've been pulling them since they were about 6 months old. Put them on skis last year, and I think they just kind of looked at me and asked where the cookies were. But we're hoping this year. I think our approach is going to be just put the equipment on them and let them do with it what they want to, a slow approach.
And in terms of a different kind of skiing, downhill skiing, how does that differ from cross-country skiing?
Well, downhill skiing, you let someone else do all the heavy lifting, that meaning you up the hill. And cross-country skiing, you're propelling yourself. So any hill that you encounter, it's your job to get up that. That's part of the appeal to me, though. I mean, that downhill run through the trees is something that I've earned. Not something that I've just paid for. And that said, I love downhill skiing as well. But there's just such a peacefulness of cross-country skiing that really struck me. I was a downhiller and mocked cross-country skiers for a long time, and then when I got into it, I really found the error of my thinking on that. It's just a beautiful way to get out into the woods.
Last time I was out on cross-country skis, I saw people on, I think what they're called, skate skis, which
That's
is almost
right.
like a... I mean, those people really cruise quickly
yeah,
in that.
Yeah, they're flying. They
Nothing
are flying.
To sniff at there. Tell us about skate skis.
Well, skate skiing is a little bit different motion. The skate name is very applicable because you're pushing off in a, as you would on roller skates. And so that's a much faster way to propel yourself. It is a little bit more challenging at the beginning of the learning curve for skate skiing. The technique is a little bit more difficult to get early on. But once you get going, that can be a blast, too. You feel like you're just flying through the woods. So that has really been a boon for cross-country skiing because in the late 80s or mid-80s, once that took off, that really drew a lot more people into the sport.
In terms of the price tag on downhill and skate skiing, how does that compare to cross-country skiing?
Well, skate skis are probably at the same price point as your traditional diagonal stride cross-country skis, and those can range upwards to about $500 to $600 for a high-end race ski. Or, again, you can get yourself set up for a beginner package in the low $200 range, maybe even something under $200. Downhill ski equipment, I haven't priced it in quite some time, but I remember downhill skis being in the $400 and $500 range just for the ski alone. And then, you know, the lift ticket is also something to keep in mind. If you're going to take a family of four to a downhill ski area, that could be a fairly pricey endeavor. Most cross-country ski areas, all you need is a state trail pass, and I think that is now $20 for the annual pass, but I'd have to check that number.
We're talking with outdoor writer Tom Held about ways we can get outside and enjoy the winter with some cold weather sports. We're taking your calls. What is your favorite winter sport and why? Have you gotten a chance to do it yet, or has the weather been just a little too warm in the southern part of the state at least? And what are conditions like up in the northern part? What are you doing there that you love to stay active when it's cold out? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion now with outdoor expert Tom Held about winter sports. And we're taking your calls. What is your favorite winter sport and why do you love it? What have you been doing so far this winter? Have you got the snow to do it? And if not, what are you just dying to start doing once you get the colder temperatures and maybe some snowfall? What do you do to stay active during the winter months? You can reach us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Jeff on the line from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. We actually went cross-country skiing up in Ironwood, Michigan, up in the Upper Peninsula at Adar. It's just a fantastic place for cross-country. It had fantastic snow. They do such a good job of grooming up there, but when we were driving up, you had to go a long ways before you got some reliable snow on the ground.
Oh, well, how much snow thereabouts do they have in the UP?
They've had a couple of feet, but the temperatures have still been warm. So it was slushy at times. The temps had started to fall, but they've done such a good job of grooming that even though there were basically puddles alongside the trails in places, which actually looked gorgeous and the trees were covered in snow, the tracks and the trails were still almost perfect.
Well, that sounds lovely. Well, thank you, Jeff, for calling, and I'm glad you got some good skiing in. You have a great day, too. And Tom, Jeff mentioning the UP is a fabulous place to go skiing. Where would you recommend?
I really like that suggestion, ABR, up in the Upper Peninsula near Ironwood and Bessemer. I would, if he's still there, I'd ask him to check out a place called Ski Milges. I think it's M-I-L-J-E-S. It's an old family farm, and one of the sons of the owners built up just a short cross-country ski area, probably about 5 to 7 kilometers, I think, but it is really a tight, just beautiful little spot. And that's one of those where they just have a donation box out front and a beautiful little warming shelter with a fireplace. That was one of the rare gems that I found. I don't even remember how I had heard about it or if I just saw a little sign one day and decided to check it out. And the state has a lot of those. But to your question about right now, the best skiing in the, you know, for the Wisconsinites and in the Midwest is up in the UP, but also up in the Cable and Hayward area. The Birkebeiner ski trail has been pretty solid all winter long, and winter starting back in Thanksgiving for them. And then also up in the Minocqua area, Minocqua Winter Park has been pretty good throughout the short winter season. I did some skiing yesterday, or Christmas Day, right on the Oak Leaf Trail in Milwaukee. Unfortunately, I was on my roller skis. I was getting some training in for once the snow hits, I'll be ready.
Okay, gotcha. Well, those are some good suggestions. We'll go next now to Steve in Danbury. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Veronica. You asked what it was like here in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
We're in the far northwest. And we actually got 14 inches of snow on November 11th and had just wonderful skiing before Thanksgiving Day, which has never happened before. And we thought we were set for winter. we skied the Berkey and the Vasalopet, so we were really happy to have the early snow for training. And we actually groom a 3-kilometer trail at our house.
Oh,
and,
fabulous.
We had wonderful skate skiing conditions, and bad to say, as of yesterday, we had no snow left on the ground after a couple of weeks of mid-30s temperatures and some rain thrown in, too. Last night, we got an inch of snow, so at least this morning we woke up and things were looking a little bit encouraging again, but basically we're back to roller skiing again here too.
Right, so interesting. Well, thanks a lot for sharing that, Steve. Seems like we flipped around the snowfall thing. Instead of the snow coming before the holidays like Christmas and Hanukkah, they're coming came before Thanksgiving, but now it's all gone. So we'll have to see where the weather takes us next. And we're going to go right to another caller. We've got Kurt joining us in Oregon. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. So I've been ice biking the last couple of years, which I really enjoy. And I've seen a little bit or heard about some people who are riding bikes, like the fat tire bikes on snowmobile trails, and I don't know much about it, but I was curious if you're hosted.
Great. Well, thank you, Kurt. And Tom, what do you think? Fat tire biking, how do you do that?
Fat tire biking, it's basically you have a mountain bike, a larger frame to accommodate a much wider wheel. So a mountain bike has about a 2-inch wheel on it. That's the width. Fat bike has about 4 inches, and it's really taken off in the last, I would say, 5 years, and just for the reason that the caller mentioned. Snowmobile trails work well for that, although that has some user conflicts because if snowmobiles are whipping down the trail at 40 miles an hour, it could be problematic. But there's a couple series of races that have started up, and the mountain bike trails in the Southern Kettle Moraine State Forest, that would be just a little bit east of Whitewater, are open for fat bikes. And then there's a winter series in Wisconsin. So that is really picking up. And even the Birkebeiner is having a big, what they call is the World Fat Bike Championships on the Birkebeiner Trail. As long as it is packed down, and that's why snowmobile trails work well. The fat bikes work great, and people just love them. It's a way that you can extend your biking season year-round. If that's your real passion, you just want to ride your bike every day, well, you can get a fat bike, and you can get out on the snow and have a really tremendous experience.
Now, I know how to ride a bike, but does that mean I can automatically do this ice biking, fat tire biking thing, or is there a whole different skill set?
Do you feel very, very embarrassed if you fall over?
Well, I've fallen over before. I don't know. Okay. It's not my favorite thing in the world. But
falling over into a snowbank is a lot different than piling up on the asphalt. So I think that's some of the appeal of fat biking. It depends on the conditions. If you have a good, solid snowpack and it's been knocked down pretty good and other people have ridden on it, then, yeah, you can pick it up. One other great area where people have been taking fat bikes on Lake Michigan shoreline, that sand, especially in winter, becomes hard packed, and where, you know, you wouldn't take a road bike with those skinny tires on there, but you can certainly get out there with a fat bike, and you will see things that you never thought you would see in terms of experiencing the Lake Michigan shore. We were out a couple of years ago in January on fat bikes, and it was a blast. So that's a pretty new phenomenon, but something that's really extending or opening up new opportunities for bicyclists.
And Tom, in our last minute here, you wanted to mention the International Paralympic Nordic Skiing World Championships that are coming to Wisconsin next month. What are you excited about on that one?
Well, I think that that's bringing 200 just remarkable athletes to the Cable and Hayward area. That's going to be at what was the Telemark Resort. Those trails are going to be hosting these phenomenal athletes. You've got a couple of people that are really impressive, some soldiers who were wounded in Afghanistan that lost their legs, and they're competing in cross-country ski races on what's called sit skis. So they're propelling themselves only with their upper bodies. You've got athletes that are cross-country skiing with one arm. You have athletes with some severe vision limitations. So I think one of the comments, you know, these are people that could have given up, you know, at various points along their struggles, but instead of doing that, they're out there and they're setting an example for all of us.
Well, Tom, thanks a lot for joining us and telling us about all these winter sports.
All right. My pleasure.
That was Tom Held, freelance writer and blogger for the Active Pursuit and Silent Sports magazine. He was with us to share some winter sports. Coming up, we look at the year in Wisconsin news. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we look at what did and didn't get done in Congress this year and what we can expect when the new legislature convenes in January. First, we look back at the news of the year, including the race for governor, movement on the same-sex marriage question in Wisconsin, and lots more. Noah Ovshinsky is our regular news guy here on Central Time. Officially, he goes by assistant news director at WPR. He stopped by earlier this week to talk with Rob Ferret about the year in Wisconsin news.
Noah, welcome back, and happy almost end of the year to you.
Happy almost end of the year right back to you, Rob. It's good to be here.
Where did the time go?
I don't know, but I do know it had 2014 was a crazy year in the news business here in Wisconsin.
A lot happened, and it maybe because of that, that's why it felt like this year flew by so quickly. Well, one story that we've been watching here for years. This goes back before 2014. Act 10, this saga, the budget repair bill from years ago, changes to collective bargaining for public employees. Wrapped up in many ways this year.
Yeah, put to bed officially. At least the legal fight over Act 10 officially came to an end this year. In July, the state Supreme Court declared it constitutional.
And there were a lot of different court challenges to the whole thing, to bits and pieces of it. They've all pretty much petered out now? Still floating?
This,
I don't know.
I mean, the legal fight over Act 10 is essentially over. Mm. I think the question now is, is there going to be new legislation in 2015 dealing with unions?
Yeah. What have we heard so far? I mean, the session hasn't even started yet.
Right.
But there's talk. There's already talk.
There is talk. And probably the next battle in the fight over the – we'll call it the role of unions in the state. And it will likely come in the form of a renewed effort to pass right-to-work legislation. The governor says it's not on his agenda, but he also hasn't said what he would do if the legislature put it on his desk. And, of course, the caucus in both the Assembly and the Senate is a bit more conservative than it was previously. And so I think there's a chance that we may see right-to-work at least considered seriously by the legislature.
And now right-to-work, that's the name supporters usually give to it, and it's kind of become a catch-all. What is it in a nutshell?
It can come in a few different forms, but essentially it prohibits a business from, you know, mandating the collection of union dues as a condition of employment. And this is primarily – we're talking about unions in the private sector.
Mm-hmm. So if I go to a workplace that is a union shop under right to work, I could say, yeah, I'll take the job – but I'm not going to be part of the union. I can't be compelled to be part under right to work laws.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Well, another biggie, and this one. So this was a year of the courts in many ways.
Yes, it was. You'll be hearing a lot about the courts and lawyers in the next few minutes.
Right. And there's a year of elections too, and they came together in the ongoing voter ID saga.
Right. So we saw a lot of this issue this year. Obviously, it was a big election year as far as the governor's race is concerned, and so a lot of people were paying attention as to whether or not it was going to be in place in time for the November election. And just going back in time briefly, you know, this was something that was in place for, I think, one election in 2012, and then almost immediately entered legal limbo and has been in that limbo, you know, since 2012. The Wisconsin Supreme Court this year upheld the voter ID law. And it eventually ran into trouble in the federal courts.
Yeah, and we were seeing this on a lot of stories. There's the progression through the state court system and the federal court system. Now, what happened this year in the federal courts when it comes to Wisconsin's voter ID?
Right, so it's been resolved on the state side. On the federal side, actually, an appeals court in Chicago upheld the voter ID law. Basically, Judge Frank Easterbrook, who wrote the opinion, basically said not having a photo ID was a matter of choice.
Right. Well, holding it there. Yeah. So holding it stress. Oh, not. Yeah. So all of a sudden they make this ruling.
Yes.
Voter ID's on.
Yes. Voter ID. And we're talking about just a matter of weeks before the election.
We're going to have it. We talked to, you know, Kevin Kennedy with the Government Accountability Board, how they're going to get this thing into place.
Yes.
And then.
And then the U.S. Supreme Court steps in and suspends its implementation just before the November election.
Yeah. And so why?
Well, you know, no rationale was given, at least by the majority in the court. You know, in the past, the high court has been, I guess I'll call it hesitant, you know, to allow changes in election law so close to an actual election. You know, they want to minimize the chaos associated with that kind of thing. Of course, we don't know exactly why they did it, but that's something that has been an issue in the past.
But that decision affected the November election. That did not strike down voter ID in the future.
No, it did not. It just meant that voter ID was not going to be in effect for this last election.
So it seems, if that's the case, then voter ID legal challenges may have run their course unless somebody somehow gets the U.S. Supreme Court to take up the validity of the law.
Exactly. And this is something the Supreme Court has dealt with previously. I mean, they have upheld voter ID laws in the past. Mm. And so I think, you know, voter ID certainly, I would think, has a future here in Wisconsin. I think it's a matter of timing at this point.
Yeah, and that appeals court you mentioned cited that past Supreme Court decision and saying, hey, there's no reason to overturn this local federal judge. Don't overturn the Supreme Court here.
Exactly.
Okay, well, you know, still maybe – we may still be talking about this next year, or we may just be showing voter ID at the polling stations next year.
Yeah, I think it's a good chance that that'll be the case.
All right. Well, let's complete our court trifecta here with – and this is a huge national issue too. We're seeing state by state having same-sex marriage bans struck down. Mm-hmm. Catch us up on Wisconsin this year.
Right. So, gosh, let's go back in time. The first – a judge here in Wisconsin struck down the law prohibiting same-sex marriage in Wisconsin. The U.S. Supreme Court earlier this year refused to hear cases from five states, including Wisconsin. And that act of refusing to hear those cases officially made gay marriage legal in the state of Wisconsin.
So in this case, it was a U.S. Supreme Court non-decision
exactly,
that had a
right.
big effect
here. They declined to take up the opposition's a case, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of like voter ID initially with that ruling here in the state from a federal judge. There was a stop and or a go and stop sort of thing. People were briefly getting marriage licenses. That was put on hold
exactly.
until the Supreme Court weighed in or, as fates had it, didn't.
I mean, there were legal dramas. Mm-hmm. I mean, consequential legal dramas playing out in almost every level of courts, both here in Wisconsin and in the federal courts. I mean, it really – 2014 was an amazing year for the courts.
Yeah. So current state of affairs, same-sex marriage, legal.
Legal.
The constitutional amendment banning it is
unconstitutional. I will say that the conservative organization that you know really pushed for that referendum, the constitutional amendment rather, Wisconsin Family Action, you know, the officials with that group say they will continue this fight and that it's not over.
I mean, unless, again, they can get the U.S. Supreme Court to do something. I mean, like voter ID, there's not much more up to go there.
That's it. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court is it. And it remains to be seen if they will, you know, revisit or how they will revisit the gay marriage issue.
We are talking to our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, recapping, updating the top stories of 2014. Just some little stuff left coming up. But, you know, the governor's race and some other things.
That's Rob Ferret with Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director, talking about the big news in Wisconsin over the past year. More on that conversation coming up. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Earlier this week, our news guy Noah Ovshinsky sat down with Rob Ferret to recap the top Wisconsin stories of the year.
Okay, Noah, I teased that that story. It kind of was under the radar, not really in the headlines. This race for governor, this is something you, I know, it's a hobby of yours, these little stories.
Yeah, I heard something about a little governor's race here in the state. No, this in fact, was a huge issue that we've talked a lot about on this show. It was an issue, of course, that the residents of Wisconsin experienced both in the press and on TV in the form of nonstop campaign ads and issue ads and things of that nature. But the headline really here, the takeaway is Governor Walker survived his third election essentially in his first term. I think that's certainly for him a testament to his electability in the state.
Now, leading up to the election, a lot of the pundits who came on the show, the analysts said, you know, people are thinking jobs and the economy in this. Is that how it actually ended up playing out in the race?
Yeah. I mean, the campaigns for the most part centered on basically who would be better for the state's economy, that is, who would create more jobs, and who would be a better steward of the state's finances. Mary Burke argued that the state wasn't doing well enough. She referred to, among other things, the governor's promise a few years ago to help create 250,000 new jobs in his first term. That, of course, you know, did not happen. She pointed that out. The governor argued, though, that the state was headed in the right direction. It wasn't where he wanted it to be, but that it was headed in the right direction and that under his continued leadership, you know, things would continue to improve.
And what kind of, policy decisions that he made, things that he'd implemented, did he point to as to back up that argument?
Yeah, I mean, he used tax cuts, certainly, as an example, Act 10. He also talked about the tuition freeze in the UW system, used issues like those to bolster this argument that, you know, he was a good steward of taxpayer money.
All right. Well, don't keep us in suspense. How did this end?
He won.
Okay.
He did. And, you know, I think there were several interesting takeaways from the election, and you know, one of them I guess I'm a sort of a nerd when it comes to these kinds of things, but it actually, if you look at the numbers, it showed that Governor Walker really, despite the campaigns, was no more popular or unpopular than he was when he took office in 2010. That's despite everything that happened with Act 10 and the other controversies that kind of surrounded the governor in the last few years.
Okay. And what else? Any other takeaways for what helped Governor Walker win re-election?
Yeah. I think the Republican tide, you know, that swept the nation certainly helped the governor. And I think the fact, frankly, that Mary Burke was not able to get the Democratic base to buck that trend that, you know, I think haunts most midterm elections for Democrats. And that's the fact that Democrats simply don't show up in large numbers in non-presidential years. And so her campaign just was not able to get enough voters to the polls on campaign day to make a difference.
And just briefly, before the election, the Republicans controlled the Senate and the Assembly. After they controlled it by more, and you mentioned earlier a stronger, conservative majority, not just Republican, but conservative majority when all was said and done.
Yeah. I mean, we're looking at the 2015 legislative agenda is going to reflect a caucus that is a legislature that is more conservative. Some of the moderates, you know, who may have been more willing to cross the aisle and so forth, they've either they've retired or have just left the legislature. And the people that are being, elected to replace them are more conservative. So I think we will see a far more conservative agenda in 2015 than maybe we've even seen in the past.
And we'll get into that more next week when you'll join us to kind of forecast, preview the stories to watch in 2015.
Yeah,
and that
absolutely.
Is going to be one of the big ones,
absolutely.
What they're going to be coming
yeah,
up with.
Yeah, no doubt.
So another story we've been following, and this one, a news still breaking as recently as this week, a police-involved shooting, Noah, in Milwaukee.
Right. So Dontre Hamilton was killed in April by a Milwaukee police officer, Christopher Manny, in a park. The officer was essentially doing a welfare check, seeing if Dontre Hamilton was okay. He tried to frisk Hamilton, who was mentally ill. Some kind of fight broke out, and it resulted in Hamilton being shot 14 times by the officer killing him. His death led to protests since April, sporadic protests, and as you alluded to, news in that case coming this week.
Yeah, so back on Monday, a big decision on that resulted in more protests.
Right. So the district attorney in Milwaukee County, D.A. Chisholm, opted not to file charges against the officer in the case. He said that the evidence basically pointed to the fact that it was self-defense. The officer was basically operating in self-defense when he shot Hamilton.
So there has been some consequence for the officer, not in the courts, but in terms of his continued employment in Milwaukee.
Right. Manny was, in fact, actually fired by the Milwaukee Police Department, not for the shooting itself, but for breaking procedure, essentially allowing the situation to escalate the way that it did. That, of course, caused a lot of controversy, especially among those in law enforcement who felt like he shouldn't have been fired. And since, of course, April, there has been efforts to get the police better training to deal with the mentally ill to perhaps avoid situations like this.
And we heard from Mayor Barrett himself actually talking about a new program where they're going to try to get what's considered the gold standard of training for all officers, which would, I think, be a first, at least among major departments. Well, another piece of news breaking on this after that decision, something from the federal government.
Right. So on the same day that D.A. Chisholm announced that he wasn't going to file charges against the officer in the case, the Justice Department announced that it will investigate the incident for possible civil rights violations. So, again, that's something that will also play out in 2015.
And this, of course, is against a background of other shootings, other racial tensions around the country.
Right. I mean, the shooting and the protests. I mean, this came in a year and is coming in a year when the relationship between the police and the public, certainly more specifically the black community, has really been under a microscope, especially in light of what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and what's continuing to happen more recently in New York City, where a man selling individual cigarettes had died after he was put in a chokehold by police. So again, what's happening in Milwaukee, all of this is happening with the backdrop of what's happening nationally, which is this microscope and this attention being put on this relationship between the police, law enforcement, and the black community.
Yeah, this is one story that we will not stop talking about in 2015, I've got a feeling.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Well, one that you've been following on WPR News, very interesting story on rail traffic and oil.
Yeah, so this is one of the issues that we've talked a lot about this year, and it really has affected the state in some, I think, big ways. The oil rush that's happening right now in North Dakota and Canada means there is a lot more trains carrying a lot more oil through our communities here in Wisconsin. And, local officials have raised concerns about the safety of these trains in light of some recent very high-profile explosions, including one that essentially leveled a small town in Quebec earlier this year. Mm-hmm. There's some debate about the safety of the train cars themselves and the ability of fire departments, especially here in Wisconsin, rural fire departments, their ability to deal with an explosion should one occur.
And I think there's been reporting here about some members of our congressional delegation asking questions, at least about what you mentioned, the safety of those train cars. So that's one that's still up in the air.
Yeah, I mean, these questions are being raised by, both local communities and in Congress. The other way this sort of increasing train traffic also played out in the state and also affected the residents here in Wisconsin is, this oil rush also meant that other products weren't being shipped. In particular, coal and other agricultural products. And this year, utilities were actually having a hard time getting enough coal because the trains were so busy shipping the Bakken oil from the Dakotas.
So the coal-fueled power plants that a lot of communities rely on were having trouble just finding the cargo space to get the coal to them.
Exactly. And trains are a big way that happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, This is a new world of energy in the United States. I mean, what's next?
Well, you know, the reality of the energy industry, I think, is that, you know, the oil is going to flow.
The oil must flow.
The oil must flow.
Quote Dune.
Exactly.
Yeah, or paraphrase it. Yeah.
I mean, it's going to flow. And, you know, as the country, as our political leaders, you know, continue to debate the Keystone Pipeline and other pipeline projects, infrastructure projects, you know, while all that's happening, the railroads have really picked up the slack or are trying to pick up the slack. And the question moving forward is, you know, how and frankly, when are the railroads going to be able to build this capacity to deal with this oil while at the same time improving safety, which people would like them to do? So I think this is certainly an issue that is, again, going to continue to play out as we look at 2015.
Well, one story that's going to be finished for better or worse in the next couple of weeks, another playoff run for the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, exactly. They've got their last game here of the regular season coming up on Sunday against the Detroit Lions. And of course, they're both going for the NFC number one spot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Lions, their defense is tough. It's going to be a tough game, I think. It is a consequential game. But the Packers, you know, I think most people would argue, with the exception of one or two games,
right,
have really been in top form. Aaron Rodgers has performed. Eddie Lacy has, like, brought back the
running game, which has been missing for the Packers.
Yeah. I mean, he's single-handedly.
The defense has shown up from time to time.
The defense has showed up. We certainly saw that in the last game against the Buccaneers.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky recapping the year that was in state news. A little bit of Packers thrown in there, and he had that conversation earlier this week with Rob Ferret. Wisconsin life now. Ice skating is one of the pleasures of winter. Many neighborhoods have their own rinks. Writer John Hildebrand tells us about learning to skate backwards.
Last year, the city announced it was mothballing most of the neighborhood ice skating rinks. A city crew would no longer flood the rinks on successive freezing nights or pay listless teenagers to sit in overheated warming huts. Budget cuts was the reason given, though there was also a string of freakishly warm winters. As a consolation prize, a few large rinks remain open. But I miss the one in our neighborhood, the one we could walk to, the one where my children learned to skate. It's one more instance of the landscape of childhood giving way to that notoriously poor substitute, memory. But whose memory? One of the weird pleasures of parenthood is making children reenact some tableau from your own childhood, and nothing is rigged with deja vu like a skating rink at night. It's one big memory sink, the dome of darkness overhead, the scuffle of skates, the way everything shimmers in the cold night air. I have a persistent memory of skating backwards with a girl under the lights. It's a school night, and I've been dropped at the city rink. Snow is falling heavily out of a blackness that begins just beyond the arc lights. And there's music. The entire rink revolves slowly on its axis as a loudspeaker blares the skater's waltz. Among those orbiting past is a girl from my class, someone I've never spoken to, but whose mere presence elicits a strange new excitement. She's wearing a nubby blue sweater and a short woolen skirt that's left her bare legs red in the cold. I push off, weaving between skaters until she's just ahead, trailing a fragrance equal parts wool, freshly washed hair, and chewing gum. A few powerful strokes and I glide past her, then, amazing, pivot, so we're face to face, skating in perfect rhythm as she smiles and offers up her arms. Except it never happened. I didn't learn to skate backwards until I was in my 30s. So the whole episode is a false memory, a scene concocted out of adolescent longing or something I must have read. When I finally learned, the knowledge came too late. Too late to play hockey or meet girls, but in plenty of time for me to teach my own kids to skate. Now that the kids are grown, my wife and I will sometimes drive to one of the remaining rinks on a winter night and circle the ice in an approximation of a waltz. It looks romantic only because you can't see the stagecraft, the hand squeezing that signals a turn, or the way we keep time by humming the brutal cadence of the skater's waltz. Dum, dum, da-da, da-da-da-dum, while alternately pushing and pulling each other around the rink. It's not dancing so much as balancing, a kind of novelty act, marriage on ice. Still, when we lock arms and go into a spin, faster and faster, and everything blurs together except her astonished blue eyes, I think, this must be love.
John Hildebrand is the writer of several books, including his most recent, The Heart of Things, a Midwestern Almanac. Coming up, this year was the least productive for Congress since 1973. We'll look at what lawmakers did and didn't get done in 2014. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. News is next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.